This is The Big Breakdown, a long look back at some of the biggest stories we're covering for you at the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today. This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Here now, Tony Bruschi.
Nick Reiner walked into a Los Angeles courtroom this week, sat behind a glass barrier in a brown jumpsuit with his head shaved, and spoke exactly two words when it mattered: not guilty. And I can already hear the reactions. How can he plead not guilty? We know what happened. His parents were found stabbed to death in their bedroom. He was arrested the same day. There's allegedly security footage. Witnesses who saw him at a party hours before documented history that leads like a roadmap to tragedy. How did this happen? Well, if you've been following any court cases ever, you'll see a trend of people who are clearly guilty of a crime pleading not guilty. So what's he doing? What is the play here? That's what we're going to get into. And I'd love to get your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube as we work our way through it. The links to get there are in the descriptions. Just search Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi on YouTube or hiddenkillers.substack.com. Here's what most people don't understand about the plea. It wasn't a defense. It was a door. And what's behind that door, number one or two, is the real question we should be asking. Because not guilty in a California courtroom doesn't mean what you think it means. Not in a case like this. Not when mental illness is going to be the centerpiece of whatever comes next. Let me explain how this actually works. In California, you don't just walk into an arraignment and announce that you're pleading insanity. That's not how the system is set up. If you want to pursue a not guilty by reason of insanity defense, you enter what's called a dual plea. And you plead not guilty and not guilty by reason of insanity at the same time. And then something interesting happens. The court splits your case into two separate trials. Phase one is about guilt. Did you do it? The jury decides that question first, and during that phase, your mental state isn't even part of the conversation. You're presumed sane. If they find you not guilty of the act itself, you walk. Case over. But if they find you guilty, if the jury decides, yes, you did in fact do this thing, then and only then do you move to phase two, the sanity trial. That's where a jury decides whether you understood what you were doing, whether you knew it was wrong, whether your mental illness was severe enough to excuse the act you've already been found to have committed. Two trials, two separate questions, guilt first, sanity second. So when Nick Reiner stood in that courtroom today, or the other day, and his public defender said not guilty on his behalf, that wasn't him claiming innocence. That was him preserving options. That was a placeholder. Well, the defense figures out which door they're going to walk through. And there's really only three available. Door number one. Let's see it, Bob. It's a brand new insanity defense. Not guilty by reason of insanity under California's McNaughton standard. This is the one everyone thinks about when they hear insanity plea. And it's also the hardest to pull off, Bob. Here's what McNaughton requires. You have to prove the burden is on the defense here, not the prosecution. That the moment you committed the act, you either didn't understand the nature of what you were doing, or you didn't understand that it was morally wrong. It's a high bar. It's not, I was having a mental health crisis. That's not, my medication was off. That's complete detachment from reality. Believing your parents are demons, thinking God commanded you to do it. Not understanding what a knife does to the human body. That sort of thinking. And here's the problem for Nick Reiner. Hours before his parents were found dead, he was at Conan O'Brien's Christmas party. Multiple sources reported that he argued with his father there, got into it with Bill Hader. Witnesses described him as disruptive, acting strangely, interrupting conversations. But he was arguing. He was engaging. He was present enough to disagree with people about things. Legal experts have already weighed in on this. Former prosecutor Nima Romani, who's been on the show many a times, put it bluntly. If you're capable enough to have an argument with your parents at a Christmas party, you're not legally insane. The standard requires total psychosis. Thinking your victims are aliens. Complete inability to distinguish right from wrong. Having a bad night at a party doesn't meet that standard. Professor Lori Levinson at Loyola law school, said the insanity defense is actually really tough to win. It depends entirely on what experts say about whether the defendant had a mental disease or defect severe enough that he didn't know what he was doing or didn't know it was wrong. That's the bar, basically. Nationally, only about 1% of criminal defendants even attempt an insanity defense, and of those, most fail. So if full insanity is there, it's a long shot. What's behind door number two, Bob? Well, this is where it gets even more interesting and honestly more likely. California abolished something called diminished capacity back in 82. After the Dan White case, you might know it as the Twinkie defense, even though that's not actually what happened. But that's the story for another day. The point is, California voters were so outraged by the verdict that they eliminated diminished capacity as a full defense. Here's what survived. Here's what could be behind door number two. Mental illness can still be used to challenge the specific intent required for first-degree murder. First-degree murder in California requires premeditation, deliberation. The prosecution has to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the defendant planned the killing through and through, acted with specific intent. If the defense can show that Nick Reiner's mental state at the time, his schizoaffective disorder, the medication change reportedly made a month before the killings, whatever was happening in his brain that night prevented him from forming that specific intent, the charges could be reduced. Not dismissed, but reduced. First-degree murder becomes second-degree murder or voluntary manslaughter. The death penalty comes off the table. Life without parole becomes life with the possibility of parole or something less. Former Judge Halim Deandra, who's both prosecuted and presided over cases in California, said directly, "That's not really what we have here, in my opinion," when asked about the full insanity defense. "But you could have a situation where illness can reduce the crime from murder to manslaughter. This is almost certainly the real play. Not acquittal, not freedom, but changing the name of what happened and the consequences that then follow." Then, of course, there's door number three, which is different from the other two. Mental incompetence to stand trial. What does that mean? Well, this isn't about Nick's mental state on December 4th. This is about his mental state right now. Can he understand the proceedings against him? Can he participate in his own defense? Can he communicate with his attorney and make decisions about the case? If the defense argues he can't, if they claim he's too mentally ill to even stand trial, that triggers a whole separate process. Psychiatric evaluations, hearings, potentially months or years of treatment at a state facility until he's deemed competent enough to face the charges. It's a delayed tactic, but it's also a legitimate question in some cases. At Nick's first court appearance back in December, he was wearing a suicide prevention vest. Attorney Mark Garagos noted publicly that this was a red flag for competency issues, which apparently come up frequently in parasite cases. We don't know yet whether the defense will raise this, but it's a door that remains open if the price is right. So where does all of this leave us? Well, DA Nathan Hochman hasn't decided whether to seek the death penalty yet. He said publicly he'd only pursue it in rare cases, but the special circumstance allegation, multiple murders, use of a deadly weapon, makes Nick eligible if prosecutors choose to go that route. The psychiatric evaluations are ongoing. Reportedly, Nick has been meeting with medical professionals who are assessing his mental state at the time of the killings. Their testimony will be central to whether defense emerges here. The preliminary hearing is set for April 29th. That's when we'll get the first real look at the evidence. After that, depending on motions and delays and the complexity of the mental health issues, it could be a year or more before this goes to trial, if it goes to trial at all. Because here's the thing about cases like this, they often don't. Plea deals happen. Charges get negotiated. Families express preferences about outcomes. The prosecution weighs the optics of putting a severely mentally ill defendant on trial for his life. We don't know what the Reiner siblings want. Jake, Romy, and Tracy haven't made public statements about the case. The family has said only that they have the utmost trust in the legal process. Not much to go on. And I'm going to speculate about what they're feeling or what they want to see happen. They've lost both parents in the most horrific way imaginable, allegedly at the hands of their brother. Whether they're going, whatever I should say, whatever they're going through is far more than most of us can really comprehend. I think the question that needs to be asked, the question that's going to define this, is how people react as this case unfolds. What does accountability look like when someone is both sick and choosing to stay sick? Nick Reiner had resources most of us can only dream of. According to reports, he went through at least 18 rehab facilities over the years, all paid for by his parents. He had access to psychiatrists, medications, treatment programs, interventions. His family put him under a conservatorship in 2020, the legal arrangement that gave a court-appointed guardian control over his medical decisions, including psychiatric medications. The conservatorship lasted a year. When it ended in 2021, sources say he went back to his old patterns, resisted authority, refused to follow programs, considered the whole arrangement beneath him. In a 2015 interview for that film, Being Charlie, film about addiction based loosely on his own experiences, Nick said the rehab programs hadn't worked for him. I just couldn't get by in these programs. I had resistance every time they tried to reach me. Yeah. Rob Reiner, his father, said at the time, when Nick would tell us that it wasn't working for him, we wouldn't listen. We were desperate. And because the people had diplomas on their wall, I want to throw up every time I read this. We listened to them when we should have been listening to our son. I think about that quote a lot, and I throw up a little bit in my mouth every time. A father blaming himself for not listening, for trusting the experts instead of his kid, for trying too hard in the wrong ways. And now that father's dead, allegedly killed by the son he spent decades trying to save, manipulated by that little monster. If the defense successfully argues that Nick's mental illness is his schizoaffective disorder, his medication issues, whatever was happening in his brain prevented him from forming the intent required for first-degree murder, what does that mean? It means the legal system will have found a framework for what happened, a category, a name. But it doesn't answer the harder questions, the one that families dealing with addiction and mental illness and dangerous relatives ask themselves every day. When someone has every resource available and refuses every intervention, when they resist every attempt to reach them, when they reject the help that might have prevented tragedy, how do we hold that? Mental illness is real. Schizoaffective disorder is a serious brain condition that affects cognition, perception, mood. Medication changes can trigger episodes. None of that is made up. And also Nick Reiner, by his own account, resisted every program, considered being under someone else's authority beneath him, valued his freedom over his stability. Both things can be true, the illness and the choices. The disease and the refusal. This legal system is going to try to sort this into categories. First-degree murder or second-degree murder or manslaughter. Legally insane or legally sane. Competent to stand trial or not. But the reality is messier than any of those categories allow for. Two people are dead. A man who made some of the most beloved films of a generation. And a woman he loved for 36 years also dead, found in their bedroom with multiple stab wounds. On the first night of Hanukkah, hours after a Christmas party where their son caused a scene. And their son walked into a courtroom, slumped in a chair behind glass, and let his lawyer speak two words on his behalf. Not guilty. That's not the end of the story. It's barely the beginning. April 29th, preliminary hearing. The psychiatric evaluations, expert testimony, legal motions, and eventually, maybe, a trial that will force a jury to answer questions that don't have clean answers. What did Nick Reiner understand on December 14th? What was he capable of knowing? Did he plan this? Or did something in his brain break in a way that erased planning from the equation. And underneath all of that, the question the legal system can't really touch. What do we owe people who refuse to be helped? What do we owe the people they destroy? Two words in a courtroom today, a lifetime of questions behind them. Your thoughts in the comment section on YouTube or our Substack. The links are in the descriptions. And leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. If you're finding our reporting valuable, we greatly appreciate that. Take us with you on the go. Press subscribe, whatever platform you're listening to us on, so you don't miss any of our coverage of any of the cases that we follow for you right here. Looking forward to your feedback on this and where you think this is going. We'll continue the conversation there in the comments. Until next time, my name is Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast. This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Here now, Tony Bruschi.
Romy Reiner is 28 years old. She's a photographer and an artist. On December 14th of 25, she got a call from a massage therapist who couldn't reach her parents for a scheduled appointment, so Romy went to check on them. She walked into her parents' home in Brentwood, and she found her father's body in the master bedroom, and she called 911. And somewhere in the hours that followed, as paramedics arrived, as police took over, as news began to spread through Hollywood and beyond, Romy learned that her brother Nick, the one who'd been living in the guest house on the property, was a suspect. He was arrested that night near USC. He's now charged with two counts of first-degree murder. We spent a lot of time talking about Nick Reiner on this show, his mental illness, his legal problems, his not guilty plea, the defense strategies that might be coming. But today I want to talk about the people who haven't had a lot of focus on them, who we haven't focused on enough, the ones who have to live with what happened, the ones who didn't choose any of this, but will carry it for the rest of their lives. Jake Reiner, Romy Reiner, and Tracy Reiner, the ones left behind. Jake is 34. He was a news reporter in Texas and California, including at CBS Los Angeles, before following his father into the film industry. He's acted in a few projects, including Being Charlie, the 2015 film his father directed and his brother Nick co-wrote, the one about addiction, the one based on their family's real experiences. Romy, as I mentioned, is 28, a photographer, like her mother, an artist, the one who found the body. Tracy is 61, Rob Reiner's oldest child, adopted during his marriage to Penny Marshall. She saw her father at a family gathering the day before he died. When asked for comment after the news broke, she said simply, "I came from the greatest family ever. I don't even know what to say. I'm in shock." Three siblings, three people who woke up on December 14th with parents and went to bed that night without them. But here's what makes her situation different from almost any other grief you can imagine. These aren't just mourning children. They occupy three roles simultaneously, and those roles don't fit together cleanly. First, they're the primary mourners. There's no one above them in the family hierarchy now. No parents to defer to, no elders to lean on. They are the top of the family tree, whether they're ready for that or not. Second, they're the victims next of kin. Under California's Victim Bill of Rights, Marcy's Law, they have legal standing. The DA has said he'll consider their input on major decisions, including whether to seek the death penalty for their own brother. Third, they're the family of the accused. Nick is their brother. Whether he allegedly did, or whatever he allegedly did, they share his DNA. They share a childhood. They share parents that are now dead. All three roles at once for the rest of their lives. A few days after their parents were found, Jake and Romy released a joint statement. Words cannot even begin to describe the unimaginable pain we are experiencing every moment of the day, they wrote. The horrific and devastating loss of our parents, Rob and Michelle Reiner, is something that no one should ever experience. They weren't just our parents, they were our best friends. They asked for respect and privacy. They asked for speculation to be tempered with compassion. They asked for the parents, their parents, to be remembered for the incredible lives they lived and the love they gave. What they didn't say, what they didn't need to say, is that they're now trapped in a legal process that will drag on for years.
When Nixon attorney, former attorney Alan Jackson, withdrew from the case back in January, the family released another statement. This one was shorter. They have the utmost trust in the legal process and will not comment further on matters related to the legal proceedings. That's the public posture. Trust the process. No further comment. But think about what the process actually requires of them. DA Nathan Hochman has said his office will take the thoughts and desires of the family into consideration when deciding whether to seek the death penalty. That sounds like it gives them power. It actually doesn't. Legal experts have been clear. Family input is meaningful, but it's not controlling. Prosecutors can listen to the family and still do whatever they determine is appropriate based on the evidence, the law, and their own judgment. Sources say the Reiner siblings have made it clear they don't want the death penalty for Nick, but that doesn't mean they'll get what they want. It just means they had to have that conversation. They had to think about it. They had to form a position on whether their brother should be executed for killing their parents. That's the cruelty of this situation. Even when the legal system offers the family a voice, exercising that voice requires them to engage with questions no one should ever have to answer. Let me talk about grief for a minute, because there's a body of research on what happens to siblings when they lose a brother or sister, and almost none of it applies to what Jake and Romy and Tracy are going through. Psychologists talk about something called disenfranchised grief. It's the phenomenon where surviving siblings feel their loss doesn't count as much as everyone else's. When adult siblings die, or an adult sibling dies, they often leave behind parents, a spouse, children, people whose grief is more socially recognized. The siblings get pushed to the margins. Their pain is real, but it's treated as secondary. Researchers at the Trauma and Grief Center have documented this. Somehow, their grief doesn't feel as important or relevant as the grief of their parents, one psychologist noted, and that's a big problem. But the Reiner siblings don't have parents to defer to. Their parents are the one who's died. There's no one above them in the grief hierarchy. They are the primary mourners, whether society recognizes it or not. And on top of that, they're dealing with factors that compound trauma in ways the research barely covers. Romy found the body. That alone can cause post-traumatic stress that lasts a lifetime. The deaths were violent. Homicide grief is different from other kinds of loss. It's complicated by investigations, legal proceedings, media coverage, and the knowledge that someone chose to do this. And the person who allegedly chose to do this is their brother. That's a particular kind of grief that comes when a family member is responsible for another family member's death. There's a very specific type of grief there. It doesn't fit neatly into any one category. And mourning the dead, while you're mourning the dead, you're also mourning the living, the sibling you thought you knew, the person who's now in a jail cell, the relationship that will never be what it was. Sources say Jake and Romy have completely cut Nick off. They're not visiting him in custody. One insider said the decision is rooted in devastation over their parents' deaths, not a legal strategy. But here's the thing. Nick isn't gone. He's not dead. He's not someone they can simply stop thinking about. He's going to be in the news for years. His name will come up at every family gathering. His face will appear on screens. His case will be discussed by strangers who don't know the family, who don't understand the history, who treat the whole thing like entertainment. The siblings can't grieve Nick the way they grieve, or the way you grieve someone who's died. They can't hold a funeral and move on. They can't process the loss and find closure, because Nick is still alive. He's still their brother, and he's still going to be part of their story, whether they want him to be or not. There's another layer to this that I keep coming back to thinking about when going through this. Jake and Romy and Tracy knew who Nick was before December 14th. They lived through the years of trying to help him. The 18 rehab stints, the conservatorship that lasted a year and then ended, the periods of hope followed by periods of collapse. A family friend who stayed with the Reiners shortly before the death described dinners where everything seemed normal. Nick helping out, washing dishes, watching TV with the family, looking like he was on the upswing. The siblings carry all those memories now. Every good moment with Nick is shattered by what came after. Every warning sign they had dismissed now looks like something they should have acted on. That's a particular kind of torture. The what-ifs. The should-haves. They're wondering whether any of the years of trying ever mattered. Whether anything could have changed the outcome. Whether there was some moment where intervention might have made a difference. There probably wasn't. The research on parricide, the killing of parents by children, is clear that severely mentally ill offenders often have histories exactly like Nick's. Diagnosed conditions, medications that work until they don't, treatment that's accepted and then rejected, families who try everything and still can't prevent the worst. But knowing that intellectually doesn't make the guilt go away. It doesn't stop the replaying of conversations, the second guessing of decisions, the wondering if you could have done more. So what does healing look like for the Reiner siblings? I don't think there's a clean answer to that question. I don't think there's a version of this where they get to grieve in peace and move on with their lives. Consider the possible outcomes of Nick's case. If he's convicted and sentenced to death despite the family's reported wishes, they'll have to live with knowing their input didn't matter, and potentially years down the line, they'll face the question of whether to witness their brother's execution. If he's convicted and sentenced to life without parole, they'll spend the next several decades knowing he's alive in California's prison system, a permanent presence and name that will come up every time they introduce themselves to someone who follows the news. And if he's found not guilty by reason of insanity and committed to a psychiatric facility, they'll have to process the legal system's determination that their brother wasn't responsible for what he did, even as they carry the weight of two parents who are never coming back. There's no outcome that gives them their family back. There's no verdict that restores what December 14th took from them. And in the meantime, the process grinds on. The preliminary hearing is now scheduled for April 29th. That's when prosecutors will present evidence and a judge will decide if there's enough to proceed to trial. After that, there will be more hearings, motions, delays, psychiatric evaluations, legal arguments about mental illness and intent, and what Nick did or didn't understand. It could be more than a year before this goes to trial, and it likely will take possibly longer if it goes to trial at all. And through every stage of that process, Jake and Romy and Tracy will have to decide how much to engage, whether to attend hearings, whether to speak to prosecutors, whether to issue statements, whether to watch the coverage or look away. They'll have to figure out how to be a family without the two people who held them together. How to celebrate birthdays and holidays, how to answer questions from well-meaning strangers, how to introduce themselves without inviting a conversation about the worst thing that ever happened to them. They weren't just our parents, Jake and Romy wrote. They were our best friends. That's who they lost. Two people who loved them. Two people who shaped who they are. Two people whose deaths will define the rest of their lives in ways they never asked for and can never escape. They asked for privacy, they asked for compassion, they asked for their parents to be remembered for the love they gave. What they got instead is a spotlight they didn't seek, a legal process they can't control, and a grief that doesn't fit into any box society has built. The preliminary hearing, like I said, is in April. The death penalty decision is pending. The trial, if there is one, is somewhere on the horizon. And through it all, Jake and Romy and Tracy will have to keep living. Keep working, keep breathing, keep finding reasons to get up in the morning when the two people who believed in them the most are gone. They didn't choose this. They didn't ask for this. They're just the ones left behind. And if you've been one left behind, you know what that pain is like. Look forward to your thoughts in the comment section on YouTube or our Substack. The links are in the description. You can also press subscribe wherever you get this, whether it be YouTube or Apple Podcasts. Please do hit subscribe. We do greatly appreciate that. And if you got a moment and you're valuing our reporting, leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. We'll continue our conversation in the comments section. Until then, I'm Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers Podcast.